Hey folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. It's an interesting one and a different one this week because it's one guest and it is a 90-minute interview with Bruce Thomas. I often record long interviews and then edit them way down for broadcast, just kind of leaving in the best stuff. But this one I did edit out just a little, maybe 10 minutes, and what's left is about 90 minutes. And I just figured, you know, I think folks who are interested in this will be interested in all of it, and maybe there'll be a few folks that it's just too much for. And that's the beauty of WFMU. Who else, where else am I going to get the opportunity to air a 90-minute interview with anyone? So Bruce Thomas, amazing bass player, amazing musician, innovated and inspired, and still does. It's an incredible story of this guy taught himself how to play bass, played in a bunch of bands, which I did not know, and then new wave music came along, and all these people just kind of changed their tune, literally, and the Attractions were born, and it was an amazing ride for, you know, almost 20 years, just constant touring and recording, and the story of how it ends, how it began, I find it all very fascinating, and I hope you will too. I spent a lot of time this week preparing for this interview and going through that Elvis Costello and the Attractions catalog and listening to all the music and listening to how important the bass is to so much of it and how much of the hookiness comes from the bass and just what it adds. Just their whole chemistry was just very unusual, and Bruce Thomas a huge part of that. So he hasn't stopped since he's left the Attractions, but he's doing a bunch of different things. So we touch on a bunch of that. He's written a bunch. We touch on all of that, but visit his website and check him out. Another thing I wanted to mention is that, you know, since the quarantine, we have a lot more folks listening on the web and all over the world, and a lot more folks commenting on the message boards during the live program. So if you get a chance, listen on Saturday morning. And there are often hundreds of people commenting, and they're all very clever and funny and knowledgeable. And if you haven't visited us there yet, it's an interesting community. So just come by and say hi on one of the message boards that are on every playlist Saturday, 11 to 1. That's it. I'm taking a week off next week. Mr. Finewine's filling in for me. I'm working on booking some guests, so keep your eyes over WFMU.org/Michael. But now, one incredible, really just kind of really enjoy this, and the feedback from folks who listened was so great. So I hope you enjoy it. It is 90 minutes with me and Bruce Thomas. Enjoy. Okay, here he is, finally. We've been hearing some Bruce Thomas-related music all morning, and I've got him on the telephone now. Bruce, good morning. How you doing with the whole being locked in your house situation?
To be honest, it's not a great deal different to what it's like normally. I live in a very quiet village, and if anything, lockdown's more exciting than it was before.
So, interesting. I've read your book, Rough Notes, which is your autobiography, and folks can get information at brucethomas.co.uk. So much interesting stuff in there, and I want to start at the very beginning. You were born in a place called Stockton-on-Tees in England, and often when I speak to folks from the UK, they have sort of a particular pride for where they're from, or there's a certain sort of reputation of those folks from that area. What's the thing up there?
Nothing. The best thing that ever came out of Stockton-on-Tees is the road south. I could dispense with that one fairly quickly.
Oh, tell me about your childhood. What did your folks do?
My dad worked in he was kind of a foreman in a factory basically, and my mum was a homemaker until the kids grew up, and then she went back into motor insurance. But nothing. My dad was a musician, but going in the army kind of put a stop to that, you know. Mm. So he got a job when the war was over.
But overall, happy childhood, would you say?
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't beaten. I wasn't starved. I mean, I had loads of countryside to play in and go for bike rides and woods and fields and, you know, all that kind of thing. So, yeah. And plus, of course, pivotal to all that, as I entered early adolescence, was the rise of the great British beat boom and Beatlemania and everything like that, and The Who and stuff like that. So who's complaining?
Yeah. At a certain point in the book, you make, there's actually a photograph of this homemade bass guitar that you've made, and it's truly a work of inspiration. What inspired it? Why and how?
Lack of money. It inspired me to make one, and for some reason, I decided to make a violin-shaped instrument like you-know-who. It's not the most... I've actually still got it hanging on the wall outside my office here where I'm sitting. And I retrieved it a few years ago from the family loft, and it was there. It's only got one string on it now, but there it is. And next to it is my signature bass, which, you know, was done a few years ago, which a company in England did a signature model with, you know, with my name on it. So I thought, well, that tells a story from such humble beginnings.
Yeah. Interesting. How many hours were you practicing in the early days?
All day. I made that guitars, I have to say, is technically wrong, because I've only put 11 frets to the octave on it instead of 12. So all the intonation must be completely out. I'm playing Arabic music from day one. But I just used to sit, copy like the simple riffs like Green Onions and stuff like that. And I used to sit and play along with the TV. If there was like any time an ad came on, I'd try and play the part, you know, just listen to it and pick it up. So I learned from listening to records and TV, and pretty much had it on my knee all the time, and even slept with the blooming thing, you know.
So when you say all day, you're not exaggerating, you would have your hands on the bass 8 hours a day?
8 or 9 hours a day, yeah. And the, you know, people in you know, all my contemporaries at school were, yeah, obviously all got guitars and then gave up after a week or whatever, but after a year. You know, I'm a big believer in the 10,000 hours theory, you know, that you must, the key to learning is repetition. And you just have to do it and get it in your muscle memory.
Oh, there's a big difference between, you know, an adolescent boy in his room playing along to records and playing with a band. It's a whole nother thing. So you are you're in tons of bands, and it's interesting because you cross paths with lots of folks who do go on to have professional careers, like Paul Rogers from Bad Company and Free. And
well, I was in a band with Paul Rogers. Yeah. I mean, I played at home for a while, but I also played the harmonica, and I got up and jammed with a local band playing, you know, the old, the ubiquitous favourites of the day, like Got My Mojo Working, all those things. That's what, you know, the English R&B beat groups were playing, and I played with them. So I got offered a job playing harmonica with a band called The Tremors, and then one day the bass player didn't turn up, and they knew that I, you know, messed about on the bass at home, so they said, right, put the bass on. You're playing bass tonight. And I kind of got through it all right, so I got the job, basically. And when that band folded, because all the members went off to university and things, I joined, and I left school by then as well, and got a job in on a newspaper in the Arctic as a graphic designer, as they call them nowadays. On the local newspaper, two of the guys that worked there were in a band called the Roadrunners, one of whom was Paul Rogers' who was the bass player, who wanted to stop bass playing and take up the lead singer role full time, which turned out to be a dreadful decision, didn't it?
What was the scene? Was it just teenagers dancing to these kind of blues, young blues bands?
It's like, you must have seen the Tom Hanks film, you know, that thing you do. You know what it was like, you know, everywhere was like a kind of the cavern or something like that, you know, some kind of bunker full of noise.
And packed with young folks. It's kind of an amazing little, you know, snatch of time, because it was a golden era,
definitely. Yeah.
So also a golden era for bands coming, even though you lived up, bands still came through there, including the Beatles and all these amazing package shows.
We got all that. I mean, before I even left school, I'd seen the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Solomon Burke, the Kinks, the Who, the, you know, Swinging Blue Jeans, blah blah blah. They all came through. There was a package through every week. Yeah.
Oh, how amazing! And tell me, I mean, just, did the Beatles blow everyone's mind?
No, you couldn't hear them. You couldn't. I mean, there were two Vox AC 30 amps and a 50 watt bass amp. And 3,000 screaming girls. Guess who won? You know.
That's incredible. Wow.
But I saw the Beatles. I never say I heard them, but I saw them.
So of those other bands you mentioned, were there some that you could hear and some that were a revelatory experience for you?
They were all a bit of a revelation, but I tell you, the band that I heard and then couldn't hear for several days afterwards was The Who, you know, who were so loud. They've always been my favourite rock band. So and later on, as I jump forward, when I ended up in being a professional musician, I was in a band that toured with The Who as a support act. So I saw them live many, many times. And I've the best rock and roll or best rock gig I've ever seen is The Who, hands down.
There's a funny story in the book where I think when you're still young, you sneak backstage and Pete Townsend gives you some advice.
He does. Am I allowed to say that? Because I said to him,
you can try.
Hey, well, I'll tell you what, you can edit it if you like. But he asked Pete Townsend if he got any advice for an aspiring young musician. He said, yeah, just take loads of drugs. So I can't say I took him up on the offer straight away, but there you go.
So you eventually decide, you know, you want to be a bass player. And it's amazing that you cross paths with a bunch of amazing guys who are around the scene, but still accessible. And I want to mention Peter Green, because he passed away recently.
And you know, I was, I'm the, if you go on my Facebook page, I did a eulogy, I suppose, to him, you know, telling the story that I'm probably going to tell you now. And I had a shipload of, I had over 1,500 people get back to me on it. So he touched a lot of people. All those musicians, it was a music scene, and musicians swapped around lineups of bands, swapped genres, all sorts of things, you know. It was very... I've when I first moved to London, I had been in cafes and had a lunch with Mick Fleetwood, Rod Stewart, you know, went round to Jeff Beck's house, John Mayall's house, and they didn't say go away, you know, they would talk to you. If you say, oh, so-and-so, tell me about this or that, and they'd engage in conversation. There was nothing... You know, none of the Kim Kardashian business going on.
Yeah, it's amazing. And clearly, Peter Green, the way you describe when you write about him, he basically sort of the best guitar player you've ever seen in a
not
way.
Just the best, not just the best guitar player, the best musician. And to put things in perspective, I've kind of re-evaluated it recently. And although I can give you the names of the obvious bass influences like McCartney and Entwistle and Jameson and so forth, Peter Green, I think, actually influenced my approach to playing music, his musicality, and the way particularly that he honoured the song and the melodic or harmonic content of the song and served the song, rather than just blasting licks across it, you know, like so many guitar heroes do, you know. He played straight from the heart without anything, without any intellectual or any barriers. It came directly from him. And I think I can't, there's just no other musician or singer I can think of, apart from maybe Aretha Franklin, that could just take it, deliver it straight from our inner self, you know?
It's interesting also that as such a young man, you were able, you had the sensitivity to feel that, to see that from him. I won't make you tell the whole story again, but I'll tell it real quickly. He was looking for a bass player. You said, come to my house because I've got drums and bass here. And yeah, for a couple hours, you guys jammed, and he said, you're not quite there yet, kid, but keep at it.
Yeah, yeah. I was only playing a couple of years. He said, just... Yeah, you're not quite ready, but I also knew that the job was only a placeholder till John McVie got free from the Blues Breakers, so it would only be a temporary job anyway. But if you think about it, Peter Green was only 19
at
the time. You know, you talk about me having the sensitivity. Where did all the sensitivity for the supernatural or something like that, you know, that's on the early Mail album? I mean, he's 19, 20, and he's playing like somebody with the maturity of several lifetimes. I guess I guess there are just certain people that you know, have the windows open to start with.
Yeah, it's otherworldly, absolutely. There's no answer, yeah, for sure.
No, it's like Mozart or anybody, you know, any of these prodigies. He was a bass player to start with, Peter Green, you know. So, and he converted to guitar.
You mentioned John McVie. I love his bass playing. Are you into that?
Yeah.
So you eventually joined this band Quiver, who do open up for The Who, which is, you know, baptism into the deep end of rock and roll there. And it's interesting because 1976, you play on Al Stewart's The Year of the Cat, which is a huge hit. You hook up with the Sutherland Brothers, who opened for Elton John, another huge thing. You're doing some sessions. You're making a football team record. You start. you're in a band called Moon Rider. And it's interesting to me that all of these bands, there's not a hint of new wave, really, I would say. I mean, there's slightly country, slightly proggy, slightly all kinds. Was that all in? Was the new wave thing, or was some kind of change in the air? Could you feel it coming?
I was in a band that was kind of like Eagles wannabes, you know? They were saying, never mind about the bass playing, you've got to learn how to sing a third harmony. And I go, oh, Lord, you know, spare me. And and the thing was, the guys in the band were, you know, they had a very good backstory. And I said, oh, I know you can play this stuff. Let's just for me, just to humour me, play some R&B, you know, at a rehearsal or something. Just play My Baby Left Me or something. And I said, that's what I want to be playing. You know, I don't want to do any of this. I mean, you know, hitching down the freeway of my stoned and moody mind to see my little denim lady in LA business, you know?
Yeah.
That, which is my kind of stock cliche song lyric for those periods. But it's I don't want to wear turquoise jewelry or cowboy boots or look like Leon Russell or no. And so I was getting this independently of probably several others. The band I was after joining at that particular time was hooking up with Wilco Johnson, who just left Dr. Feelgood, and playing that kind of stuff, you know, just R&B. And then of course, then the Attractions thing came up, so we went off.
Yeah, so you could feel it in the air. Were you hearing, like, okay, so clearly Dr. Feelgood and those sort of pub rocky bands that were turning into something else. Like, you know, you say that Wilco Johnson, just R&B, but it's much, but there's a fierceness to it that was missing. Yeah. So there's an ad in, I believe, Melody Maker that says rocking pop combo seeks That's happening bass player. And and you call over to Stiff Records, and you figure out it's Elvis. You go out and buy some 45s and learn them so that when you show up to the audition, you are prepared. And I believe is it you, Elvis, and Steve Goulding on the drums?
Yeah.
So you walk into this room, and was Elvis on your radar before this in any way?
No.
So you went to
the... I didn't know what he looked like, or... I mean, I did once. I bought the singles and saw his picture and... Heard some of the tracks, and I pretended I was just hearing them for the first time and learning them really quickly, which I could do anyway because I was doing sessions. I could pretty much pick something up after one time through. But he wouldn't make eye contact at all ever during the whole period. You know, he was very kind of look anywhere but at me. So I don't think he was that keen on having me. I think it was Pete Thomas that swung it.
Because Pete had been a fan of Quiver, is that
Quiver.
Right?
Yeah, Pete was a fan of Quiver, and Pete basically said, if you don't get this guy, you're mad, you know.
So during this first audition, Elvis is just racing through songs, staring at anything but you.
And he's going through one or two songs. I'm picking them up, apart from the ones that I haven't got the singles for.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think? Did you think this is something new? This guy's got talent. Did you remember, or were you just trying to get the changes?
I got the changes quite quickly. I just thought, this guy, I can't believe anybody sweats that much. That's the thing that... That is an honest to goodness impression that remains with me, is of this guy absolutely drenched in perspiration, you know?
Yeah, that's amazing. So pretty quickly, like you said, Pete Thomas is drafted to be the drummer, and you guys have some sort of a relationship. And
I know Pete. I knew Pete used to come to our gigs and hang about in the dressing room, and I knew his pub rock band, Chilly Willy. I don't know if I tell the story in the book, but Pete Thomas was inspired to turn professional because he once saw me get out of a cab, go and get some takeaway spare ribs and get back in the cab. And he thought that was the coolest lifestyle thing he'd ever seen. So,
wow. To keep the meter running, yes. How absolutely posh, yes.
Yeah.
So Steve Naive, keyboard player, I think he's 19 or something, super young, and there's the band. You're in the band, and when you come back, you are in a room now for the first time with Steve and Pete and Elvis and yourself.
Yeah.
And when you started playing right away, was it apparent how good it was going to be? And was there a lot of discussion about how the approach was going to be, or did it just happen organically?
The only discussion about the approach was that Elvis said there's going to be no guitar solos in this band. After that, we just started playing. I mean, the very first time we played together in this rehearsal room, we changed I Don't Want to Go to Chelsea from a sort of Kinks-style number to the arrangement that you hear today. And we were also having discussion about what to call the band. Elvis's preferred band name was the Sticky Valentines, but I managed to override that.
Was the Attractions your suggestion?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was, because I thought it sounded quite like, you know, the Temptations and Motown, and plus, obviously, you know, the old gig posters for future Attractions and things like that. So yeah, I was on a roll that day. I came up with the bass line to Chelsea and the name for Steve Naive and the Attractions. And don't let anyone tell you different.
Yeah, it's a good day's work, yeah. So you go out of town for a week to rehearse. You've got to learn all the songs from the first album. And then Elvis starts adding in these new songs that are all going to end up being on the soon-to-be-recorded second album. A bunch of things to discuss here. First is just the approach on bass of the songs on this year's Model, the second album. It's so far away from, you know, the Eagles or Fleetwood Mac or anything anyone knows just about. I mean, it's from a different thing. I mean, it works totally 100%. But, and so did, again, was that discussed or did you just start doing that? Because it's not what you were doing in Quiver. It's not, you know,
I don't know where I don't know where it came from, but I mean, if you listen to Elvis pre-Attractions, he sounds like he wants to be Brinsley Schwartz or Nick Lowe.
Absolutely.
I don't know where it came from that something like Lipstick Vogue, probably, you know, that is the one. It's like, where the hell did it come from? I just started doing it. But it was like the well had been filling up for 10 years and it was just bursting to come out. You know, something new. Look at the Beatles, for instance. You know, you could say they were a very good pop group, and all of a sudden they're writing stuff, and you think, where did that come from? That level of quantum leap in creativity. Well, we know it was LSD with them at one point, I guess, which opened a certain floodgates, but that wasn't the case with us, because it was a different, you know, different era. But you're right. I mean, there was a huge shift from what everyone had been doing previously. Even Elvis didn't have the persona that he had on this year's Model previously. And even Pete wasn't drumming like he was drumming, and Steve didn't know any different because he thought he was joining an Elvis Presley tribute band anyway.
let's go back just 1 minute. One of the interesting things is when you guys reworked all the songs from My Aim Is True, Elvis's first album, and it's very interesting because to me, you sort of just touched on this, that, you know, you, if it wasn't for the cover of that record, if you just listened to it, it could have, that artist could have gone in any direction. You know what I mean? It's not necessarily a new wave record until you see the cover. You're reworking all these songs. Was there a song that from the first album of those songs that you just loved to play the bass to?
I mean, I thought they were all good songs to play to be fair. The song structures and changes and things that you can make something of, but they're also kind of classic. I mean, Miracle Man's like Chuck Berry, Come On, or No Dancing's a sort of specter-ish sort of arrangement and different things. I just think we just gave it so much more attack.
Oh, yeah, it's like a steamroller, you know? Just get out of the way.
If Elvis had gone on and done the songs for this year's Model with Clover, who were the country rock band on the first album, would it have been the genre-defining critics' choice, you know, album of that year? Because, you know, I've seen the polls where this year's Model beats Blondie and Bruce Springsteen and The Police and everybody and The World and His Wife as the critics' choice album. So it definitely had mega impact, but yeah. would obviously it wouldn't have done if he'd just used the same band as My Aim Is True. So
it's an interesting thought. I mean, I agree with you. I still think it would have been a great album because the songs were great.
Some of
my favorite Attraction stuff is bootlegs or radio broadcasts of you guys playing songs like Blame It on Kane or something, where it's just, I mean, it's just a wall of, you know, it's dangerous. It's just some amazing work going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's supposed to sound like the band or something, you know, the band, doing something off music from The Big Pink or something, and it's full on.
Yes.
It sounds like Vanilla Fudge.
Oh, way faster than Vanilla Fudge. So I want to ask about this sort of persona of Elvis. I mean, it's literally a made-up name, right? It's not the guy's name, and he went from wearing overalls to dressing in this completely other way. Was how much of that was this, like what you said, 10 years of pent up whatever was inside Elvis waiting to get out, and how much of that was record company or marketing idea?
Well, I know Jake came had something to do with coming up with the name, and the girl that answered the phone at Stiff Records when I rang up for the audition, who I later married, was previously an advertising shoot stylist, and she went out and bought the glasses, you know, she went out and bought the Buddy Holly specs
but the ad, was the attitude real, or what were they egging him on?
I don't think he needed much egging on. I think he was, I don't think it was manufactured to that degree. I think it was there, like it was with all of us. It was just, as John Lee Hooker said, if it's in him, it's got to come out, you know?
Yeah, but, okay. So you're in this room, you guys are playing for, you know, getting ready, and was it apparent to you, to everybody, to Elvis, what a world-class band this was right from week one?
Pretty much, yeah. We rehearsed for a week in Cornwall, and then we had our debut gig in Cornwall, and we were supporting Wayne or Jane County, as she was then, and we went on and did the set, and she came out into the dressing rooms. Who are you guys? And I said, well, you know, told him, he said, but I've never heard you before. And we said, well, you won't have, it's our first gig. We've only been playing a week. And he said, Jesus, I can't follow that. And just very honestly, you know. And second night, we did a gig in the church hall where we'd been rehearsing. And the record, Jake and the record company came down, all the employees and everything came down from London and everything. We did our set, which was, you know, the reworked My Aim Is True and the songs, embryonic songs for this year's model. And he, you know, he was being just like the Tom Hanks character in that film. You've got to run on, you've got to do this, you've got to stand or walk up to the mic. Oh, I said, Jesus, it's a world-class band. You know?
That's amazing.
So, is the short answer to that.
So this is sort of a simple question, but maybe complicated. I don't know. Was Elvis appreciative? Did you know? Was he beside himself because he had this band to realize his songs?
He never said so.
Okay,
it's a bit like the old. Well, he wouldn't the old Northern father who never praises his child. You know. The you know, it's like those movies where there's some redemption between the son and the father at the end, and but I've always loved you, Dad. I've always loved you, son. But you don't get to hear it at any time until the last minute.
Interesting, but you did eventually hear it.
He kind of. This is difficult for me to. I think when he says I had a great band, it's because it's in response to questions like what you asked. It never felt like it was spontaneously offered. I'll leave it at that, I guess, because no, I mean, he told me he never listened to the bass, you know. Somebody said he's good, but, you know, and he said, I don't know, I don't listen to the bass. I don't know whether that's just being arch or perverse or what, but I thought, well, thanks, you know.
That's funny.
I don't listen to the words, to be honest.
And there's lots of them. So things things are moving unbelievably fast. I mean, know, from the world of denim and, you know, rhinestones or whatever to, you know, just tons of gigs, tons of recording, tons of press and just, you know, television, everything. Elvis Presley dies. You know, just everything is sort of speeding up this momentum.
Unfortunately, Elvis Presley chose to die on the day we had two double page spreads in national tabloid newspapers, which were scrubbed for his obituary. There you go.
Yeah, not well. You did fine in the end. So let's talk about recording this year's model, the second album, the first one you guys play on. How much did songs change from when he brought them in because of the three of you adding, you know, good ideas to them?
They would. Some of them. Chelsea would definitely changed a lot. That sounded more like a Kinks ballad, and I. Changed that by doing the riff. It was later albums where we would rehearse the album. For instance, if you jump forward to Imperial Bedroom, we went and rehearsed that album. Then when we got in the studio, we totally scrapped all the arrangements and made up new ones on the spot. I mean, the genre changing arrangements, but I'm jumping ahead. But well, certainly,
how many of those types of ideas came from the three of you?
I would say quite a lot of them, you know, because some of them, the song would be basically defined by the way he presented it to us. Other times, we winged it. We made it up on the spot. I mean, there's a famous story about, B-Movie, for instance, on Get Happy. That was like a Blondie track. That was like, one of their poppy singles. Yeah. And we thought, we can't do this. We're sounding like our own impersonators, you know. And that's when I just... In fact, when you listen to B-Movie, that is the improvised bass line that everybody joined in on, and it was a one take, first time through, first take, done, record.
Yeah, wow.
But,
that's incredible.
Yeah, yeah, but High Fidelity was a slow ballad, that turned into a Motown thing. Clown Time Is Over was a slow ballad that turned into a Motown thing. There's songs like Opportunity and things like that were pop songs. We did that whole album. We suddenly said, right, we're doing soul and Motown. You know?
Well, it's interesting as you look at Elvis's B-sides and bonus tracks on the CDs as they've been re-released, you can tell that he, you know, that a lot of the songs got reworked sometimes more than one time.
Yeah.
The song's kind of constantly involved, and it's interesting to know that you guys were part of that thing.
Yeah.
So tell me just... I mean, I don't know. You discussed this a little bit in the book. I'll use the euphemism partying. How much... partying is involved in the making of this year's model, and would it have been possible to make that record without partying?
There wasn't a lot of misbehavior in that because we did seven tracks in one day, you know, on that record. So we couldn't have been too far gone.
Right, but sometimes it takes a certain, like, truck driver pills or something to get that much work out of folks.
There was always a bit of magic powder involved in the early days.
That's what That's what it sounds like to me, because I mean, just how do you play that fast for seven songs?
Oh, some of it, like some of the songs, like there's one on Get Happy, The Imposter, which I can't play. You know, I can play the line, I can't play it at the speed that we did it live on the if you look at on the Live at Campuchia gig with Paul McCartney. We do a version of The Imposter, and I think, how can anybody bloody play that?
You need lots of help. So tell me, how did it all sound coming out of the speakers, the second album? When you're recording this year's model, did it sound like something new and wonderful?
Sounded good. Yeah, it sounded good. I mean, it's a good album.
Amazing.
It's funny that what captures people's imagination at the time isn't always the one that goes on to be, you know, a classic track. I mean, I remember when we recorded High Fidelity, Nick Lowe wanted to hear it back and back and back, like, I don't know, 100 times. He just couldn't get over how great he thought it was. But although it's a good track, I wouldn't say it was even in the top 20 we ever did, you know.
Tell me, you mentioned Nick Lowe. What is Nick Lowe, like, especially on that second album, what is Nick Lowe's contribution as to the sound, to the whole thing?
To oil the wheels. To oil the wheels of industry, yeah. For instance, he came up with Pump It Up was just verse, chorus, verse, chorus, verse, chorus. And he said, well, third verse, why don't you go up to an A and just sing that in A, then it'll sound like a middle eight.
Mm.
And we went, yeah, it does. And that was, you know, that was a great suggestion.
Mm.
That was a really good suggestion. He hated, if there was a synthesizer around, he'd have to leave the room. You know, I'm not listening to you chasing sounds for an hour, you know.
Yeah. Bash it down, so, generally, when Elvis would, throughout the career, when new songs would come, would you just hear them in a rehearsal room with him running it down on a guitar or piano, or would he send demos, or how did...
Both. I mean, he once came round my house and sang a whole album with an acoustic guitar, you know. Mm. So loud that people in neighboring houses were coming out into the street to see what the noise was.
That's amazing. So, like I said, things were moving so incredibly fast. There's some great footage of you guys on, I think it's ABC, American television show called 2020, and right. Geraldo Rivero's following you guys around.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And there's some scenes where there's some outtakes of this, which you can, I think I saw on YouTube, where you guys are sort of in a supermarket buying stuff, and you're a little bit like Martians. Like, people are looking at you like they don't recognize this life form, you know? And it almost like you step off the bus as if you don't even recognize, like, a supermarket. You know, it's an incredible time.
I guess, yeah. He says to this woman at a check, and says, "What do you think of punk rock?" She says, "Ah, I always use it."
I mean, the vibe is tangible.
Yeah. I guess, looking back, it must have been. I mean, I say that in my book. When I saw the Beatles, it was. It wasn't like seeing a gig. It was like seeing Martians land.
Mm.
You know, it was like, whoa, this is a big shift.
It's interesting because while some people loved it, there were some people who were so threatened or angered by it. Did you guys encounter that?
Not directly. I mean, we've had threats in other times, but not because of that. I mean, I think we were in a bubble, and occasionally we came out of the bubble into supermarkets or, you know, truck stops in the South. Certainly, you'd like every head would turn to and swivel towards the door, you know, if you went in.
Yeah. When you guys played on Saturday Night Live and Elvis starts playing one song and goes into another, was that a planned thing, or was that a spontaneous? Did you know that was coming?
Yeah. Yeah, if you look at the that footage of that, when he says, stop, 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 you'll notice my hand moves up to the 7th fret, ready to start the next song, and people have spotted that wasn't spontaneous because he's moved his hand ready to start Radio Radio. So I thought, yep, you got that right.
Fair. Okay. I always was suspicious about that. I want to, just before we move on from the second album, because it was a giant step forward, it was a quantum leap forward. When I hear Lipstick Vogue, to me, that's in some ways just defines Bruce Thomas as a bass player. It's just, you know, it works like gangbusters, yet it innovates too. Is that something you're particularly proud of?
In retrospect, it's one of my parts that people come back to. You know, I mean, there's a website called 10 Great Bruce Bass Lines or something like that, and the guy says, even now, I can't play it. And I thought, it's become a kind of a signature riff, if you like. Yeah, yeah. Pump It Up, Chelsea, Lipstick Vogue, and then a couple of things off Get Happy and Be, you know.
Oh, there's a million amazing Bruce Thomas bass lines. Let me remind folks, yes, Bruce Thomas, bass player of The Attractions and writer and lots of things, is our guest this morning. BruceThomas.co.uk is the place to go to get
all
information.
Facebook's always a good one.
Facebook, yes, of course.
Yeah, Facebook's always a good one for... Natter.
in your book, you describe, I think Elvis is on the bus and you drive past the Hoover factory and he writes a song and you play it that night at the gig. So
that's right.
was that typical? And clearly he's like one of the most prolific songwriters ever. It's just insane how many songs he was writing and how quickly. Yeah. Did you get to witness, was he writing them on the bus or was he writing them in private? And what inspired that guy to do that kind of work?
Well, obviously not every song was inspired by driving past a building and playing it that night. But we, you know, when we were doing Get Happy, I mean, Pete gave him a line, would give him a good line, and the next thing you know, there'd be a song, you know.
So he was just a sponge soaking stuff up and then wringing it out a little bit.
He had a notebook with him all the time that he would write down lines or phrases or anything, you know, and they all ended up in songs somewhere or another. Any bit of work, there's a lot of wordplay obviously involved, and some of it which was nothing more than wordplay, you know. Some of it was almost didn't make sense. It was just...
But still, was it amazing to just see that creative process on display at all times?
I guess we took it for granted for a while, because it's in the same way that he never said, you're a great bass player or anything. I never said to him, I don't know how you managed to write all these songs, you know. Mm. It was just like, that's what we just did what we did.
Yeah. Mm. The Eye of the Hurricane.
I guess, yeah. Yeah.
It's interesting that in the early days, you and Steve Naive sing. Like, I was looking at last night, there's some video on YouTube, and here you guys are singing background vocals.
And it's not that bad, a bit ropey, but it's not that bad. And then all of a sudden, one day, the mics have gone.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
You need to ask him about that, but I think,
Well, you sort of say that at a certain point, Elvis got a little more concerned that the spotlight stay on him. And do you think that's what that's about?
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about The Attractions. Back to The Attractions for a minute. Pete Thomas, such an inventive drummer. And one of the things, and this is a bit of train spotting, but like I noticed that as you watch him play, he's often, you know, playing eight notes or quarter notes on the hi-hat, only about 50% of any given song. You know, he's so inventive, and he's not just playing that usual thing. You know, it's just so. Is he an easy or hard drummer to play with?
Easy. Very musical drummer. Very attentive. No, he's a great drummer. He's one of the best.
What a musician he is. I mean, like, yeah, he's amazing.
He's one of the few drummers that deserves to be called a musician.
Yeah, he really is. And he's done it for so long and so consistently. It's amazing. So tell me about Steve Naive. Again, his approach to just, you know, the keyboard player in a band is so from left field. Tell me about playing with him.
Well, you know, he's classically trained, so he studied classical composition, so he knows all the, he told me all about, you know, explained to me what it took me years to understand about bass lines and chord inversions and Bach, and Bach was the first bass player, really. And he would have, you know, he had this party trick where he would go to the piano and play any three notes at random, bang, 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 and he'd like play them again, and then he'd play them again, and he'd gradually work them into a completely original new piece of music. He could write any tune or whatever from three random notes, you know, because you were then, that's the whole point, you don't know. You don't know which is going to be the root note, for instance, but any three notes will make some form of, you know, will give you some starting point, as it were.
So a bit of a genius in a way.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he was because he wasn't, the good thing about Steve was, like, unlike most classically trained musicians, he wasn't inhibited by it. He didn't, just like, could only, he could play the dots if he wanted, but he also had a great capacity to extemporize or to improvise, or and also, I mean, he just loved bashing the out the keyboards, you know, and playing rock, you know. He got it big time, you know. He understood what we were about.
Yeah.
And so we all went at it, didn't we? I mean,
without a question. I want to talk about Elvis as rhythm guitar player, because sometimes I think his role, especially in the early days, as a strictly rhythm guitar player is a bit overlooked. And because in some ways, though, that is the absolute glue of the band, and it allows you guys to go off.
When he said there's going to be no guitar solos in this band, you probably didn't realize there was going to be quite a few bass solos in the form of some of the more inventive bass lines. But it's the same as The Who had a lead drummer and a rhythm guitarist, you know, and lead rhythm section, and somebody had to block it all down with chords. And Elvis's rhythm playing is probably all over the shop with timing, but fortunately Pete and I were pretty locked in. If he'd stopped and played solos, it wouldn't have worked.
No, not at all. Tell me quickly about your feeling about bass players using picks.
It's necessary for some songs. Like, I use a pick on what is it, New Lace Sleeves, because it's that percussive part. I've never felt the need to use one, and I think it affects the timing as well. Ent Whistle used Paul McCartney uses a pick most of the time, doesn't he? And Ent Whistle doesn't pluck the strings, he taps them with the ends of his fingers, he hammers them down. So there's different, and Jameson used his thumb, nothing but his thumb, and, you know, so there's three different approaches at work, but I don't find it necessary to use a pick at all.
So whatever works, you're for. One of the things that the book Rough Notes is incredible about describing is the life on the bus and the schedule. And when we say it was nonstop, it almost literally means that. I mean, out of 365 days, you guys might work 360 days, and you know, just a day off was meant making an album or being on or driving 1,400 miles or you know, playing two gigs or a television show. I mean, it is. I could see why that would drive people completely insane, and it just came on almost from the very beginning. For years, that was your life. I mean, did that just, how was that on your psyche?
Well, it's I mean, you've just described it. I mean, I'm too exhausted to answer you.
But clearly, that became part of the defining of your life.
It does get to you, yeah. Yeah, but I mean, it's a cliche, isn't it? It's a cliche of the musician on the road, and that's why so many people go weird, and because of it, it's pretty full on.
There's a night in the Holiday Inn where Stephen Stills's band is in the same Holiday Inn bar, and you're all in there, and Elvis uses the N-word, and it becomes a big news story, and really, without question, I think, it kind of alters the path that the band and the career is on.
Massively.
Were you in the room when that happened?
Yeah, I was there, right next to him, part of the argument. I mean, it was people burnt out, drunk, and basically, what started out as banter, you know, and joshing around got darker and darker, and then it got quite nasty, and then it was just, I think he just did whatever, you know, just wanted to offend and outrage, and there it would have ended. Had not, then they decided to go to the press with it all. And then, of course, we were very much in competition with Springsteen at the time. And I think they just wanted to send the English upstarts home, you know. It was like John Lennon's We're Bigger Than Jesus moment. Because we were scheduled to do a gig at Shea Stadium, and there were 250,000 ticket applications, so we were, you know, on the cusp of a very big breakthrough. As it happened, we had to sort of ride out the tour with bodyguards and death threats and all the rest of it, and then just go back to England and not set foot in America for nearly 2 years. So there you go. But as Elvis has said, and as I've said, if we had have not had that setback, if we had have continued on our meteoric rise, as it were, we'd have probably been dead within that 2 years anyway. So.
Wow. Okay. So perhaps a strange blessing in disguise. One of the interesting things that happens to you shortly after this or around this time is Paul McCartney calls you to play two songs on Back to the Egg album with Rockestra, which is his, you know, every musician
Everybody.
In England. Yeah. And there's lots of videotape folks can watch of that. That's kind of nice that first of all, that Elvis was on his radar, that the attractions were on his radar. And, you know, for Paul McCartney to say, I want you to play bass on my song, that's mind blowing.
Yeah, it was, because I mean, as I'd seen the Beatles, however many years before, and then Pete Townshend was in the band, who I'd obviously had brushed up against a couple of times with the gig and the tour you mentioned earlier, and Hank Marvin, the first guitarist I'd ever seen with the Shadows, you know, when I was a real youngster, and various luminaries. I think Dave Gilmour was there, if I'm
John Bonham. Right. I mean, that's
John
just
Bonham, and yeah,
crazy.
Keith Moon would have been there if he hadn't have died a few weeks earlier. But and so I said to the great man, I said, I've copped quite a lot off you, and I've told this story a few times, but I can tell it again. He picked up a bass and played the bass line to Chelsea, and I thought, there's Paul McCartney playing one of my bass lines. That'll do me. you know.
Thank you very
that
much.
That will do me. And people come and, you know, and Pete Townsend coming over saying, I really like your band, you know, and you're an important band and things like that. So, yeah, yeah, that was, you know, I was the only... I was the only musician there that didn't have his own trout farm.
quite quickly after that, you guys record Armed Forces. Yeah. It's not a quantum jump like between the first and second album, but there's some
stylistic
sonic,
change.
Yeah, a little bit of a stylistic change. I got a question. How did the band work in terms of money? Did you guys get paid a royalty from the albums? Were you on salary 52 weeks a year? Did you get fees for recording or specifically for gigs? How did it work?
We got paid at that time. We got a wage retainer for the gigs, and then we got profit participation on the albums, which I guess was an acknowledgement of the fact that we did quite a lot of work on the arranging and things. So yeah, points on the album, and you know, kind of, it wasn't worked out for that. You know, we didn't divide the gig money up. It just went into a pot, and we got a weekly kind of fee out of it, wage out of it, whatever.
But it felt fair?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So still
Yeah, I should have a row of houses by... I should have bought a row of houses at the time.
When you started to make money, I mean, that's always an interesting point in a young man's life. What did you do? Did you go buy, you know, Tropical Fish Aquarium or Trout Farm?
I got married.
Yes, that's one of the things I haven't really brought up, but your book Rough Notes talks a lot about your relationship and a lot about travel and other subjects.
I got married to a woman who wanted to see India, Africa, the West Indies, blah blah blah, you know.
And you saw
them all. A lot of it went on traveling. Mexico, on safari, you know. Yeah. Fair enough, though. It didn't do me any harm.
No. 1980 is Get Happy. Again, super prolific. 20 songs, a whole new style. And as you told the story earlier, that sort of just organically happened. The band just said, let's try it this way. Interesting, in the book, you sort of say that this is not Steve Naive's favorite record because the keyboards, he's just kind of organ padding through
it's a lot. Functional. Yeah, it's like Get Happy is to the keyboard player what Almost Blew the Country album is to the bass player. Not much opportunity to shine. That's whereas on the country record, you know, Naive's flourishes all over and me limping along like a horse with a wooden leg.
One of the interesting about Elvis is that he always picked interesting songs to cover. Was he a guy who spent, you know, an afternoon or, you know, time after soundcheck running to the local record store while on tour?
Very much so, yeah. Very much so. He was always in record stores and things like that, yeah. And he's got a very, you know, I mean, he's cast himself as an elder statesman, musicologist now, these days, but that was... not entirely artificial. I mean, he does know his stuff and have a very eclectic, you know, outreach, as it were.
I was listening to the tune from Get Happy, Opportunity, and the bass playing on that is just so fresh, I guess is a good word. It just keeps the whole thing alive. Were those records, like that record, 20 songs, how long to make the whole record?
Well, we started... We'd started doing it in England, and I think then we went off to Holland to do it for tax reasons. So we were over in Holland, and that's where we were. That's when the partying really got a bit out of hand. About that time, with the during Get Happy.
When you say the partying was getting out of hand, like you sort of in the book describe it all in a very good-natured way. You know what I mean? There's not a lot of people getting hurt or hurting other
people. No. It was all just, it wasn't, there was no viciousness about it. I mean, it was just like, Steve Naive being unable to play because he was hallucinating at the time.
It happens, sure.
Yeah. Just that kind of thing, you know.
Sure. One of the things that happened around this time, I'm imagining, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that by now, after, you know, three or four Attractions albums, folks were starting to notice you as a bass player, write about you, imitate you, and your influence was beginning to be felt by the next wave of bass players.
A wee bit. I mean, I was getting articles in sort of Bass Player magazine and things like that, and people doing But do you know what? To be honest, it's increased year on year since then. It's almost like there's been a reevaluation. It's almost like my stock keeps going up the further away I get from it, rather than diminishing. So, to the point where, you know, people are saying, I won't even say it because it's too vain, but...
One of the interesting things I love to do is you go to YouTube and you can watch, 50 guys try to play Lipstick Vogue or...
Yeah,
you know,
there's a lot of covers on YouTube and things like that, yeah.
Just a guy sitting in his basement, you know, trying to play what you played. It's quite inspiring to people, yeah.
Yeah, and there are some people do a very good job of it, of some of it as well, yeah.
Yeah.
I have to say.
Sure. 20 songs on Taking Liberties, which was like all the extra B-sides and stuff.
Yeah, extra bits.
1981 Trust, a little bit of a darker record, but, wonderful showcase for the Attraction. Is Fish and Chip Paper have two bass lines?
Yeah, it does, yeah. You'll hear them. Yeah, the high part is bass as well as the low part.
Somewhere around this time, it says in the book that you stop drinking quite as much. What was the wake-up call for you?
Hearing somebody screaming because they thought I was dead. Basically. Ah, I thought you were dead. What?
I see. And that worked for you. You just kind of dialed it back.
Well, I was pointed out to me, and I was cajoled into, gradually reining it in a bit. Yeah.
Who was it that suggested that might be a good idea for you?
The wife.
Ah, well, okay. Well, we can thank her for that.
We can thank her for that. Yeah.
You mentioned Almost Blue, recorded in Nashville, 1982, Imperial Bedroom. You touched on it earlier, but another quantum leap forward, sonically, arrangements, just, it is a little bit of a brave move. And as, you know, I was 18 when it came out, and I had all the Elvis records up to then, and I remember putting it on and thinking, oh, they've lost it. It's, you know, this is his first bat. And then within a week, I just kept playing it over and over and over again, and maybe this is their best record. I mean, it takes a little bit of guts to change direction so completely. When you guys were making it, was it organic or discussed?
As I said, we rehearsed all the songs and then completely changed the arrangements.
But why? What was the impetus for this?
Because then it's going to be fresh, isn't it? Because you haven't rehearsed it into a set thing. He goes, right, now it's like, you know, like when we did the first album, we didn't discuss it. We just, this is how we're going to do it. Do it. Don't practice it. Don't learn it. Do it. You know? And things like, I mean, the Attractions did two of the backing tracks without Elvis ever being in the studio. We did Pigeon English and I think Boy with a Problem, and put the cassette through his letterbox. You know, it was awful, bloody terrible, and everything. But he kept it all. Yeah, and then things like Beyond Belief was done without drums because Pete didn't turn up one day. So we we did the track without the drums, and then he overdubbed the drums, and that's why when you listen to the track, there's only like cymbal punctuations through it until right to the outro when the drums come in time.
Yeah,
because he'd never heard it.
It's your first record. Nick Lowe did not produce. Jeff Emmerich had worked with the Beatles for years and years and years. You know, Sergeant Pepper. What did he think of you, guys? Sort of, you know, guy from the old school.
Jeff was okay. He was. He didn't seem like he was. He didn't seem like an anachronism. You know, because he had. I mean, crikey, the guy's got so many Beatles anecdotes that will keep him in work forever. You know.
But he has got the goods as well, right? I mean, that
of course he had. He's a brilliant engineer.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, he came up with half of the idea. You know, George Martin came up with the musical ideas, but Jeff Emmerich came up with the technical expertise to make certain things work, like syncing together 2 4-track tapes for Sergeant Pepper and compressing. You know, told me that McCartney. Even when they were recording on 4-track, things were bounced down and McCartney always had his own track, you know, and put the bass on last.
Yeah.
And that's some real, you know, and things, ideas I completely stole lock, stock and barrel off him.
Let me get for 1 minute back to the idea of attitude. In the book, you know, I won't say that... The band or you or just the whole organization doesn't have a lot of patience for anyone or anything, right? You're just sort of on this mission and in some ways it's sort of chicken and the egg, because the more attitude you put out there, the more people treat you in a way that you need to give them back more attitude, if that makes sense. You know what I'm talking about?
We had... a lot of time for the bands we liked, you know, but not for kind of the corporate, you know, bands that, as I call in the book, we used to call poodle bands, you know, bands with that looked like they got a small domestic animal on their head, you know, with the big, the big hair, that, you know, the any band that was named after a town or whatever. You know the names.
Sure, but just the idea of not to be polite to bands that you didn't like, that was sort of a new idea. Or the idea to make an Imperial Bedroom when your fans, some fans anyway, would have been happy with 10 more Pump It Ups, you know what I mean?
I guess that, I mean, I guess he's, I didn't realize it was such a big shift as you're now telling me it was, you know. I mean, I guess it is a wee bit mainstream, but I don't think beyond belief's that mainstream or, I don't know what we were doing. Sergeant Pepper, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you can hear either end of, what is it, there's one song, where there's just like about 10 seconds of this mad riff. Man Out of Time, is it?
Oh, yeah.
There's a big rackety improvisation, and like Helter Skelter or something. And then there's the stately ballad, and then there's the huge racket. But, I mean, on the recording session, it had gone from stately ballad to huge racket, but we didn't think that was, that was more than Pump It Up. You know, that was... There was still the capacity to make a horrendous noise there.
There's a great story in the book where you sort of take the piss out of Elvis by asking him to tell you the chords to Man Out of Time, and he's just going E, 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 E.
If it was that was when it was the fast version and it was just so hang on, what are the chords?
It's genius. After Imperial Bedroom came Punch the Clock, which is kind of a brittle record, but in some ways, even as a fan, I see it as the right record for the right time, and I see why you kind of went, or why Elvis wanted to go in that direction. It's interesting because it's the first record, I would guess, that where the rhythm tracks are mostly not really live, and you had an opportunity to do what you just talked about with Paul McCartney, which is put the bass on, you know, probably just you sitting in the control.
I never, on any of the Elvis and the Attractions records, I've never overdubbed the bass.
Even on Punch the Clock?
Nope.
Wow. Nope.
They were like that. Were the only time I've done the bass on Lost was with in session work.
That's so interesting because I had always assumed that everything in Punch the Clock was just pieced together. Every Day I Write the Book is such an interesting song off that record because it's kind of a genre-y song at first glance, but what the bass playing that you're playing on it is, it's so moving. It, you know, so it moves around in such a way to kind of push and pull that song around.
It was supposed to be, Elvis played as, he wanted it to sound like Marvin Gaye, Sexual Healing, which it doesn't at all.
No.
And then Jake Riviera's partner, Dave Robinson from Stiff Records, came to the session. He said, the bass part's all wrong. What are you doing? The bass part's all wrong. You know, and as I put it in the book, that it's I've had lots of, you know, transcriptions of that bass part in bass playing magazines and things saying it's a you know, whatever, a masterpiece.
yeah, I think
because
it is as well.
Because it's original in its concept, you know. It's I used various different things. You can hear the references, but it doesn't fall into the genre it's supposed to. I've turned it into a pop record, basically.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Yes, like you said, it's because it's a genre record, but it's unusual at the same time, and I think that's such a great combination. Good. The album that follows that is Goodbye Cruel World, back to the same two producers again, Clanger, Winsonley. And to me, that is Elvis's first sort of not home run. I mean, you know, after eight home runs in a row.
He says it's the worst album he's ever done anyway.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I've heard worse.
So you agree. Okay. Fair enough. Right around that time, Elvis starts touring solo. It's one of the first cracks that sort of appear in this thing. And I guess it was all coming. And then 1986, he makes King of America, where basically the attractions... you sit in Los Angeles for 3 weeks in a very nice hotel and end up playing on one track, Suit of Lights.
Yeah.
Frustrating.
Yeah. Well, a little bit to know there's another band in the and another room, you know, like on the bench, you know, in a football game. Yeah. Little bit insulting. But there you go.
After that many years. I'm always curious, I don't know from your perspective if this was something you paid attention to or got exposed to, but clearly a record company is spending a small fortune to fly you to Los Angeles and put you all in a hotel for weeks to do nothing. What were the attitude of, did the record companies, were they expecting Elvis Costello to have a hit record that would make all this good?
I don't know. I've no idea on that. I've no idea what their thoughts were. I've no idea. I don't know what he was hedging his bets or whatever. I think he wanted to fire us, but he didn't because he didn't know where he was going to jump or what, who knows. I mean, I'm funnily enough, I'm just writing a different memoir now, which isn't so much music based. It's more travel. More of a travel book and other what I did on my holidays book, but I do touch against that, and I said, well, maybe he wanted to change as much as I did, you know, because it wasn't all him, you know. I mean, things had run its course, and it's just as natural that things fizzle out as they spring to life, you know, as they did in the first place.
Yeah, that's very wise. I mean, but I guess. It's just hard to know, but if he had come to you guys and said, you know what, I'm writing some other music, I want to try some other musicians, is there a way it could have been diplomatically handled? Or
it wasn't handled very diplomatically. We had to learn. It's like when, you know, people learn that they've been fired because they see them, you know, they read it in the paper or something.
Yeah.
There was nobody said anything directly. I mean,
Of course, the end is not near because Blood and Chocolate, 1986, Nick Lowe back producing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's his 11th, Elvis's 11th record. And there are weeks where, if you asked me, I might say that's my favorite Elvis record.
Yeah, it has its moments, yeah.
Oh, it's no, Bruce, no. It is, it's lovely.
It has two moments, or even three.
I promise you, there's more than three. I mean, it's such a, again, to innovate is easy, but to innovate and stay good and relevant is much harder. Mm. And
I thought that was an attempt to return to some sort of classic style that we didn't really have, or maybe, a sort of do a pop record. But I got approached by a guy who said, I'm writing a book about Blood and Chocolate. I think, can I take you out to dinner and interview? I said, of course you can. And I got there and he said, so about the album, he said, what? And I thought, I can't tell you the name of one track on it. I can't remember what's on it. What's on it? Tell me what's on it. You know, Tokyo Storm Warning.
That's brilliant.
Here Comes Mr. Misery and that one. And yeah.
Okay. So, that's so interesting for me. That's your point of view on it. Because to me, it was like, oh, wow, this is, you know, totally brilliant. And it's something old, but something new.
Something borrowed, something blue.
Yeah, that's incredible. And then October 87, the Attractions are officially fired. Your service.
I guess officially disbanded. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And like you said, what was the percentage of relief and what was the percentage of indignation?
I just at that point there was no big reaction. The only reaction was my erstwhile spouse who said, you're going to have to get a job.
Because I want to travel some more, huh? Okay.
Yeah, you're going to have to get a job. I thought, well, I'm going to do, I was still doing session work at that time anyway, so.
Yeah, well, you played with Madness and Suzanne Vega and Billy Bragg and Tasman Archer and The Pretenders and John Wesley Harding. Lots of sessions. You wrote the book The Big Wheel, which is sort of a fictionalized account of a band that's a lot like Elvis Costello and the Attractions. You also started to study Kung Fu and wrote your first of three books about Bruce Lee and Bruce Lee's teachings. During that time, what was there mailbox money for you? Because you mentioned earlier that you guys were getting a percentage.
How do you mean, what, royalties?
Yeah, royalties from...
Yeah. There was still, as long as the records sell or get streamed nowadays or get played on the radio, the cattle never go hungry.
Well, that's lovely. That's always a nice bottom line to have. I guess.
Yeah, I mean, Elvis wasn't a mean guy. Don't get me wrong. He wasn't mean with money at all. He was very fair. So, oh God, I'll have to sit down now. I've just said something nice about him.
Well, I don't. He's a complex person, I'm sure. Yeah. Did you buy or listen to Spike and Mighty Like a Rose and the Juliet Letters? Those records that came out?
No.
1984, no. Brutal Youth comes out, and you know, ding dong, surprise, they call you to come back and play with the Attractions. Nick Lowe's already played bass on a couple songs, and Elvis actually plays bass on a couple songs on that record.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
I might not have done it if I'd known that.
There's one song, I think Kinder Murder, that his bass playing is quite good, and I think he's kind of... saying what would Bruce do and then trying to do his best on that.
Because I remember doing it live on Letterman and everything, and I thought, I don't remember coming up with that part, but then obviously I started doing my sort of interpretation of it and flourishes and things, you know.
That's another record I absolutely love, and a return to form in a way for Elvis. You guys were a little bit older. You had a little bit of time apart. Was the air cleared or?
Yeah, we got on very well for a year and a half. Very well. I even travelled in his car with him and various things. Yeah, we were we were fine. We did that album and did the tours, and then we decided to do more tours going into the following year and another album. So things were going pretty well. Yeah,
you made another Jeff Emmerich album, All This Useless Beauty. Hey, I had a question for you. After all those years and all those albums, is it hard to keep whatever 300 songs in your head, or you know, could he call any of them on a given night?
No, he wouldn't. We wouldn't just pick one from 300 at random. But what we would do is have maybe a core of, I don't know, 30 songs for a tour. And then if we were going to just slip one in, we might run it through at the sound check just to check.
Somebody, I think it's a crew member, after witnessing what's going on, describes the relationship between Elvis Costello and you as mental chess, this sort of...
Yeah, it's like Niles and Frazier.
Were you guys angry at each other? Were you, what was it? I mean, what was the core?
I think I was too much like him. I had my own, intelligence or interests, you know, lively interests. I think, I don't know, might be like Mick Jagger and Brian Jones, and there's only room for, you know, I mean, he did actually say to me once, there's only room for one star on stage. He actually used those words, not jokingly.
It is bizarre. I wish I could. I mean, I find it, because it was clearly a problem with you at a certain point, you know, between the two of you at a certain point. It wasn't about the rest of the band or somehow.
No.
Yeah. And that,
as I say, why did he sack you? And I say he wanted a quiet life and he got one.
Fair enough. Yeah. So he does sack you in Japan. And I assume there's a, you know, relief and anger, etc.
Not as such. He didn't say you're fired. He just said, we don't get along anymore, do we? And I said, no, fair enough. You know, that's it. And even then, I did get a call from Pete Thomas a while later saying, how are you doing, Pete? And he said, we're looking for a bass player. And I think at that point, I was probably meant to say, found anyone, you know, and then it would all go, why don't you? Well, I said, oh, well, good luck with that. You know, it's like, as you know, in the book, I didn't realize that when Dave Gilmour asked me to join Pink Floyd, he was serious. And I said, oh, yeah, that would be good, wouldn't it? But as I say, I console myself with the fact that I wouldn't have lasted very long with them either.
It's so complex. And, you know, it's funny. I've met Elvis Costello only one time backstage. I met you the same night just asking for your autograph.
Where was that? Can you remember?
The Beverly Theater in Los Angeles.
All right. I don't remember doing that.
It was fun. And
the Wheel tour? Was Susanna Hoffs on that and Tom Waits and things?
And Tom Petty, exactly. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, Susanna Hoffs! Now you're talking.
She sings. The Bangles sing on Next Time Round, I believe. One of the.
Well, they didn't. They weren't in the studio when we did it.
Ah, I see. Gotcha.
Otherwise, that would have been the highlight of my career.
I'm sorry, but anyway, I was going to say that, you know, Elvis just seems like a normal person. He was gracious and everything, and and
when you can fake sincerity, you've got it made.
Oh, Bruce. And it's funny because in the book, I didn't know that you two were roommates in the early tours, and it even up beyond the point when you could have afforded two rooms.
Yeah, we were about 4 years we roomed together, yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned this earlier, you made a signature bass. What makes it different? Why do people need to buy one of these?
It's the same as the one I had with the famous P bass with the Attractions, but what that is basically a Fender bass that I modified. I shaped the body a bit, and shape the neck a bit and change the wiring a bit and different, you know, like Peter Green did with his guitar, basically. With his Les Paul, he messed about with it. So it was just customized for my use, but I think the customization that I did tended to improve on the stock Fender bass, and most people that have got one agree with me. So there you go.
Folks can get the information on how to get themselves one.
You can get the information off my website, or you can go to the Bass Centre, which is the company in England that distributes it, and you get in America without local sales tax, so that more than covers the shipping. So it's even cheaper if you buy it from America.
Ah, good to know. As you sort of look back on all this, and you know, 20 years with Elvis, how did that experience, you know, change who you make it? You know, the guy I'm talking to now. How did that experience change you?
It's a bit difficult to say because I can't tell you what I'd be like if I hadn't done it, can I? You can only explore one time. I mean, I could go to parallel universes and explore other timelines and come back and tell you what would have happened if, you know, if it's the butterfly effect.
Certainly, but just indulge me. Take a guess.
Go on. What would I have done if I hadn't have been? I might have ended up, I don't know. I wouldn't have been in a hit band probably, so I wouldn't have traveled as much or met as many people or be as well known, so I might be kind of delivering sandwiches somewhere on a bicycle.
Hey, you might be still working at the newspaper, who knows. So did all the mental chess leave a you know, have you done something to sort of relieve yourself of
I had therapy, you mean?
or whatever. Maybe it's your kung fu or your writing.
Well,
or
that's
therapy.
That's pretty grounding. Writing's a pretty good way of self-examination if you're honest with yourself. I mean, I've had a fairly lifelong interest in, you know, esotericism and psychology and all the rest that flows out of. I mean, Bruce Lee was. At least half of his capability was mental, not just physical. People see the, you know, the action star, but they, if you go delve into the philosophy, it goes pretty deep, which is why I wrote about it. No, I wouldn't say I was a damaged individual. I might be a bit dangerous, but not damaged.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to know. What's the best Bruce Lee movie to somebody who's never seen it?
Enter the Dragon.
When it all boils down to one song, is there one song, you know, that you, if you had to put forward one song to represent your greatest achievement known to man, what would it be?
Well, difficult. It changes from day to day. I mean, I think what Elvis's best song, and has got, and I like The Plane because there is some good music on it, but he only co-wrote it, which is Shipbuilding, which he co-wrote with Clive Langer. That's good playing on that because of the interaction I had with Chet Baker on trumpet, which I thought was magical, the way he listened and played. Other than that, you know, there's, you say Lipstick Vogue's the signature one that you would go Pump It Up that you'd go to. B-movie's really kind of clever, and all sorts of people listened to that and said, oh, I didn't realise, you know, blah, blah. So it changes from, and then other people say, oh, You'll Never Be a Man, that's the most original bass part you'll ever hear, listen, you know, and I don't know. I mean, I like some of the stuff I've done with Suzanne Vega as much as stuff I've done with Elvis, so difficult to say.
Yeah. Well, this is, you know, I loved the book. I'll say that one more time, Rough Notes, and folks can go to brucethomas.co.uk because it really is just a day-to-day look at what it was like to be there in the eye of the hurricane, and you were an eyewitness, and you still seem to remember every bit of it perfectly, and you're very honest throughout the whole thing, so I just appreciate it, and thanks for visiting with us this morning. It's been absolutely amazing.
All right, well, my pleasure, and I hope your listeners are still with you.
Thank you.